Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is New York Times reporter Adam Nagorny, author of the highly praised book, The Times, the account of that newspaper over 40 years. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, The Washington Post, Henson Shaving, and ExpressVPN in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really makes this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. James, if there was any doubt, this week demonstrated the Republican Party is unfit to govern. They killed a bipartisan immigration bill that gave conservatives much of what they've been clamoring for the last couple of years and provided Ukraine vital assistance under orders from Commandant Trump. Then Louisiana's own Speaker Mike Johnson proved that he couldn't count and failed an indefensibly stupid effort to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. The grounds, of course, were purely political. And then he tried to get too cute and end run a separate, simple aid to Israel. He lost then, too. And Johnson, by the way, also cut ties with those running his fundraising PAC. Why? Commandant Trump told him to. The GOP's dear leader also, this keeps going, deep-sixed RNC chair McDaniel, who apparently wasn't sufficiently sycophonic. That was a big surprise to anyone who's listened to her. And the biggest enchilada was the unanimous and decisive decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals panel, including a Republican judge, that Trump is not above the law and not entitled to immunity from criminal prosecution. The judicial panel clearly limited, cleverly limited, actually, Trump's option of stretching out the case by appealing to the full appeals court, so it goes directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. That will be the ultimate test of just how political that high court is. This case really is quite easy. Read the New York Times annotation of the key points of this, and you'll see that's the case. James?
Yeah. I mean, that you put a guy in that has almost negligible legislative experience. He was a kind of backbencher Republican sycophant for Bobby Jindal in the Louisiana legislature. He was picked because they couldn't find anybody else. And this little prom date did not turn out very well for him. And I don't know if he could have been Nancy Pelosi or James G. Blaine or Sam Rabin and done anything about margins like this and Trump dominating everything. But he's just another fool who Trump has exposed. I think he's happy about it. Honestly, I do. But this guy was never going to succeed, even if he would have been 50 times as savvy and clever as he is. It's an impossible job. But the question is, does it even affect anybody's view of them, or does it enhance Democratic chances of winning the House back? That's to be determined.
Yeah, I don't know. I would note that Nancy Pelosi had the same margins, and she never got humiliated like that. I'm going to stay on the court of the three-judge panel, the Court of Appeals, on the Trump immunity case. No president has been as brazen or corrupt enough to claim he's absolutely above the law, but there is a precedent of sorts. Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, who accepted it to avoid criminal charges. So both Ford and Nixon understood a former president can be prosecuted for crimes. And talking to the smartest lawyers I know, what the Supreme Court should do is just deny Trump's petition to hear this case and send it back. I don't think that's likely. But the real question is how much they want to try to stretch it out, how much the Alitos and Thomases presumably will try to stretch this thing out. Because if they can take it till June or even early July, that may make a trial really, really very difficult, which is quite of course, what Trump wants. And you know, James, the court can move with a remarkable speed when it wants to. It took 2 weeks, basically, after the Pentagon Papers case for the court to hear it and decide it. They can do the same thing here now if they wanted to.
Well, I have a slightly different take. And I understand it's everybody's going to talk about this. People should report about it, but you should comment on it. I tend to not. And the reason is we have to get on with the business of beating Trump. If this happens, but it's right now being set up is this is our Hail Mary. If we get this, then we can win. If we don't, we probably won't win. And maybe that's true. But I don't have any, there are going to be so many briefs and amicus curiae and friends of the courts and God knows what not and stories that will go away on this. And what I'm afraid that will happen is they will slow walk it or do some shit like they do. And people's morale will, it's already on the floor. It'll go through the floor. So if it happens, great. But there's nothing I can do about it. And just as a matter of personal view, if it happens, it happens. I'm not going to count on it.
Well, I think it's a much bigger deal than that. But you can't do anything about it. You can't do anything about it. I can't do anything about it. I'm not even sure Trump can do anything about it. It's up to the Supreme Court. If a majority there decides, A, they want to just deny his petition, which I think there's a case certainly to do, or if they want to, you know, expedite it and hear it sometime in late March or late February, early March, that's a big difference. If they, on the other hand, as you say, if they decide to slow walk it, he may get off again.
As I understand it, if four people, four justices can accept cert. So even if they don't have a majority, if four people say we're just going to go through like this through the regular order, so we'll schedule a hearing, and we'll do boom, 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 and so you don't have five. That didn't matter. He's escaped at that point, and I don't know why people don't think that's a real possibility.
And then it depends on when they schedule it.
Yeah, and yeah, but we're going to. Into my own view, from just my own mental health, which is something that you got to pay attention to with this guy in there, I can't make this the be-all to end-all. If I do, we're asking somebody else to do something that we as a country have, in my opinion, have got to get into business and do it ourselves. But understand everything and every side. If it happens, it happens. There's so much commentary on this. I don't, but, you know. I don't know how much.
Well, going back to the immigration bill, look, Biden is being killed politically by the immigration. They've screwed it up, quite frankly, and it's a horrendous issue for them. I don't think this is a chance to turn it around, but I do think this is a chance, if they play it right and they don't try to play to the left, to at least cut the losses, minimize the damage a little bit by saying, hey, you know, belatedly, whatever they want to say, realize that the migrant problem is severe. They had a bill, a bipartisan bill, that would have allowed us to really crack down, made asylum much more difficult. We were willing to sign it, and they said, I'm sorry, Donald Trump won't let us do it. And at the same time, decided they cared more about Putin than Ukraine. Now, is that a winning issue? It's at least less of a losing issue if they do it right. I don't know if they will, but, you know, time will tell.
I got to confess, I got a delayed flight coming in late last night to New Orleans. I got a big Mardi Gras lunch I have to go to. So I hadn't had time to read the morning computer or press that I normally do. But we did get an email from our friend Roger Altman at Evercore, who said there was a story that said the White House was relieved that it didn't pass because the progressives wouldn't have liked it. Why are these people so fucking worried about the, quote, progressive, unquote.
He wrote a subsequent memo, actually, that kind of explained it a little bit better. I mean, your overall point about the progressives, I was right on.
Right. And I'm slightly ill-prepared this morning. The plane was delayed in Atlanta, and the computer went down.
I'll take an ill-prepared James Carville over most prepared people any day of the week.
I understand, but I do know this. They have an exaggerated view. And Jonathan Martin, our dear friend of this show, wrote a very important piece in Politico about how dangerous the left is. So I guess that figures somewhat in their calculation. But, man, whatever you get from these people, you pay such a price. You know, what you get from the 9% of them, or 8% they are in the country, you pay a hell of a price with the other 90%.
Well, you sure do. And also what it does is it enables so-called neutral critics, they're sometimes not so neutral, to be even-handed. Say, well, the Republicans have their problem on the right, the Democrats have their problem on the left. They're not equal. I mean, Democrats, you know, the left can drive you crazy, and I think they hurt more than they help. But it's not the same as a mob insurrection or claiming the election was stolen or any of the other crazy things the Republican right does. But it's there and it hurts. So
yeah, it's, you know, I just, for the life of me, it's hard to see a strategy emerging from the White House. But all I know, if you look at the latest NBC poll, I mean, I've seen bad polls before. Yeah, I don't know. This one, and as you know, and as listeners of this podcast know, for many, many, many months, I've been on this. We need to try something different. This is not working. And I think he's losing a point a month. But the most telling, I don't know, I've seen a number like this. And on his job approval, it's 16 strong approve and 49 strong disapprove. That ratio, man, you don't have to be an experienced journalist, political operative, international consultant to see that's not a good number. In fact, it's a horrifically bad number.
It's the most depressing poll in a long time.
It really was. And you know, the problem is, well, it was 72% white. I mean, I'm going to make a prediction right now. This is going to... In my world, this is an earth-shattering prediction. In my lifetime, I think I'm right. Clearly, in my time in national politics, the share of the white vote every 4 years in the United States goes down. I think it was like 88 when Clinton won in 1992. I'll have to double-check it, but it was really high. And it was 69 or something like that in 2020. The share of the white vote will go up for the first time in my lifetime, and I'm going to be 80 in October, will actually go up in 2024.
Well, that's bad news for Democrats, if you're right.
It ain't good news. Let me tell you, across the board, it's not good news. And I just saw a poll in Ohio where 28% of the black males were voting for Trump. And the problem there is the progressives. It's like Nina Turner and the whole goddamn Washington NPR, don't eat hamburgers, don't drink beer, don't watch football, don't smoke dope. And those are kind of four popular things among young black males. And they're tired of being lectured to by the left wing of the Democratic Party that lectures everybody. And they're sick of it. I mean, you're black guy in Cleveland, and you're repairing tires all day. Shit, you want to watch football? You don't want somebody telling you to eat your vegetables and you should be watching gymnastics. That's not
okay. Don't eat your vegetables and watch the Super Bowl on Sunday.
Joe Biden, figure out
something to come back. All right. Hey, James, our guest is Adam Nagorny, a longtime top reporter for The New York Times, who has written a fascinating book on the 40 years at The Times from 1976 through 2016. The Times is probably the most influential paper in the world. And Adam tracks it through scandal, through extraordinary journalism, vicious infighting, and the transformation to the digital age that saved the paper. Adam, I loved reading the book, and I think it would be fascinating even for those not in the business. Two larger-than-life figures, Abe Rosenthal and Hal Raines, both executive editors of the New York Times, both brilliant journalists, but bullies who, while directing journalistic excellence, intimidated and alienated much of their staff. Tell us about them.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. They are of different eras, but in some ways similar. I mean, I think they had very strong ideas about what the newspaper should look like. They had strong standards, breaking stories, being on top of the news, being ahead of the news. I think they both had personalities that would not survive in the culture that we live in today, starting with Rosenthal. I mean, Rosenthal was really, as you said, a bully, and he was mean to people and dismissive of people that he did not like. I came across a lot of documents that showed this. People were afraid of him. I don't want to take away out from his journalistic excellence, because I do think he was an excellent journalist over the years, but he was just a tough guy. And I get the comparison with Howell Raines. I think that's very, very true. Howell also, I think, was very demanding and did not put up with fools and definitely had his favorites, I think normally based on quality or what he perceived as quality. But again, he can be dismissive of people and include some people, not others. And as you can read in the book, he eventually was forced to leave the paper because of that.
Well, Hal, you know, I knew Hal pretty well. Mm-hmm. And he, as you said, he's a brilliant journalist. But if you look at that legacy, it's going to be best remembered less for the great coverage of 9/11 than for the scandals involving Judy Miller, whose fake stories played a role in leading America to a disastrous Iraq war, yep, terrible consequences, and Jason Blair, a fabulist, whose prominent assignments and stories, he made up. These weren't medium-sized mistakes. These were massive disgraces.
I mean, I think it's disqualifying in the end. And what's sort of tragic about it, if I may, is that Howell Raines was an extraordinary journalist. He was a great writer. He wrote great stories. I think he had a really strong news sense. He had a vision of where he thought the paper should go. But those are, as I said, disqualifying episodes. Jason Blair and Judy Miller, I think they brought a lot of tarnish on the paper. I think the paper hasn't quite gotten past either one of them, frankly. And, you know, when they sort of cropped up, Howell Raines had to go. So I do think it was, you know, ultimately, I hate to say it, a failed editorship with someone who came in there with the highest of ambitions and standards.
And of the support of the publisher, Young Sulzberger.
Absolutely.
Then Young Sulzberger, no longer young. Yeah. You know, on the other side, you do some of the coverage was extraordinary. The coverage of 9/11. Mm-hmm. on their turf was extraordinary. Some of the revelations about foreign governments spying illicitly on American citizens, you know, much of its foreign coverage, it was as good as anyone, if not better, and there's just extraordinary talent at that place.
I mean, I think that's what made it such an interesting book to write about, or interesting topic to take on. There is an extraordinary amount of talent, and I think that overall, the coverage by the paper over the decades has been just exceptional and just great, as you said. But it's still with highly flawed people. And I think that for the most part, they are dedicated to making the New York Times as good as possible, but they make mistakes and they have egos and they just screw stuff up. And the paper succeeds, I would argue, despite the occasional, I don't want to use the word foibles because it suggests these aren't minor flaws, but despite the flaws of some of its players. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting place to write about, that it just keeps on succeeding and growing, even in the midst of all these mistakes and stumbles over the years.
It sure does. James?
So Adam, first of all, in terms of Howell, I'm reading or read his book on the Union Regiment from Alabama, and it's richly resourced, well-written.
Yep.
And I'm a little bit identify with that because I'm Louisiana and my great grandfather was also in the Union Army and was a Republican member of the Louisiana legislature. So I'm fascinated by the question of pro-Union people in the Southern United States. But to go back to, I'll talk about this. This was the view during the Clinton troubles that the Times was traumatized by Watergate and the Post, and that their big bet was they, and this is richly believed by everyone and richly believed by me, that they saw the Clinton scandals as their way back to Pulitzer, and, you know, the Post has a president of notch on their bedpost and the Times wanted one. Do you think we're crazy?
I don't think you're crazy. No, I never say you're crazy. I do think,
okay, I understand.
I think you have your finger on something that's correct, that the paper, the Times, was really traumatized by what happened was Watergate. And I don't think they ever really got over that. I think that influenced its coverage of stories over the years. They didn't want to get beat again or left behind again. I'm not sure that the Clinton example is the best one, because obviously President Clinton did do some things that were probably not ideal, but it is another example of that. But, you know, remember, there's a lot of years between Watergate and 1992. So I think the the kind of behavior that you're talking about, which I do think is true, I don't think it was quite as strong in 1992 as it would have been in, say, 1976. But it did, you know, James, it did turn the paper around. I mean, I think it made it more aggressive. You remember that also that Watergate happened just, I think, 4 years, Al, do you remember, after the Pentagon Papers?
It was 3 years, right, exactly.
3 years, right? So the Times was feeling on top of the world after the Pentagon Papers. This is a little bit before the scope of my book. But and then all of a sudden, they got hit by Watergate. And, you know, you still find people talking about, at the paper, talking about how embarrassing that was, because the paper is obviously competitive and very competitive with the Washington Post. And that was I would argue that was a pretty clean beat on the part of the Post.
So, Adam, during this period of time, as I recall, I guess it was during the financial crisis, basically the Times had to go to Carlos Slim and get a payday loan to stay open. Is that
14%?
Am I exaggerating that, or is something like that actually happened?
No, that right. I think it was 14%. The paper was really, really struggling financially and had to go and take the loan from him, which, as I recall, they repaid early. What are the sort of stories here? What are the sort of recurrent themes of the Times over the past 40 years? Is it goes through these financial crises and, I would argue, emerges stronger after them. When I first started writing this book back in 2015, 2016, I had no idea how it was going to end up. I had no idea if the New York Times would exist in the form that we all know it then or today, because, you know, circulation revenue was dropping, advertising was dropping, print circulation was dropping. And you look at it now and it's a real success story. One reason why I think over the years that the paper has continued to survive these crises is when they come into these periods, they tend not to make cuts in the newsroom, right? I don't want to say never, but they do. They tend not to. And the old sort of theory here, and I think it was A. Rosenthal who said this, though other people take credit for the quote, is you want to put more tomatoes in the soup. In other words, you want to, even during a time of financial crisis or difficulty, you want to make the product, I use the word product advisedly, better so that people will buy it. I think that's what the Times, in particular the Sulzberger family, has done again and again over the years. So the Carlos Slim thing, that was obviously a time of downturn, but it didn't last for that long. And I think overall the paper had figured out a way to become a successful financial organization.
I'll give one more and turn it back to Al. This is a little bit past your yearly coverage, but you've worked there and you observe it and you're close to it. And, you know, the whole James Bennett fiasco, and I believe this to be true. This is not supposition, that left-leaning people in the Times exert a whole lot of influence on what gets covered and not covered. Is that a correct observation that
I think that one of the struggles that the paper has always gone through, you see it with Abe Rosenthal dealing with what he thought were leftist journalists covering the 1968 Democratic Convention through now, is that newsrooms tend to be younger and more liberal. And that can influence what is covered or how it's covered. I think the big sort of struggle that the publisher now and the executive editor have now is to balance off these forces, to try to remain true to what people see as the New York Times mission. I'm not going to use the word objective, but you know what I mean by that.
And, I understand.
And still accomplish that. And I think that including the event involving James Bennett, right? I think this is a period of turmoil, and I think that the next book, whoever does it, and it won't be me, I don't think, unless one of you guys want to do it, will have to deal with how A.G. Sulzberger and Joe Collins sort of deal with these countervailing forces I'm a little reluctant to get to draw judgment when we're right in the middle of it. My sense is that the fever has lessened a little bit since when James got forced out because of, as you said, an uprising from some liberal members of the news organization. But it still exists, and I think, you know, it's part of this newspaper and every media organization dealing with covering the world in the age of Trump. It's a polarizing and difficult time. So I don't mean to not answer your question, but I think we don't really
quite know the answer. I thought it was about as good as good. No, we didn't. Albert.
You know, let me say with the Bennett thing, I think that James Bennett, that edit, that column that he published by Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, there were a couple of flaws in it. It was certainly defensible to run it. It was outrageous that he got fired for that. I mean, that was just simply outrageous. Now, he then wrote a really long piece in The Economist about the Times. I thought it was in The Economist.
Oh, maybe you're right. I apologize.
No, it doesn't matter. But let me give you my take on that, and then you know a lot more than I do. I thought he made some good points, but I had some real problems. Number one, he conflated the editorial page with the news pages. The publisher can put whatever the hell he wants in the editorial page. If he wants to have it all left-wing or all right-wing, I mean, the Times, whatever flaws it has more diversity in its editorial page than, say, the Wall Street Journal does. So I don't conflate the two. And I think he's right that when it comes to stories about culture and things of that sort, gays, the Times is very left-wing, very woke. But what I know a little bit about, which is Washington coverage, and I think that whether it's Maggie Haberman or Carl Hulse or Jim Tankersley or any number, I think they're terrific reporters. I don't see a woke element there. So I think it's not as easy as Bennett describes it, although I think it's clear in cultural coverage.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was saying before, that I think we're in the middle of this, so it's hard to sort of figure out where it's going and exactly where we are. But Al, your examples out of the Washington Bureau, I think are exactly right. I think the coverage out of the Washington Bureau is really extraordinarily and really straight down the middle. And I'm not going to say that from day to day that you don't see sort of examples of woke influence coverage, right? Of course you do. But I do think that overall the paper is working this stuff through. I found James' essay really compelling. The only question I had about it is whether it's possible to draw the kind of long-term conclusions that he did. In other words, to say that what happened at that moment reflects a redefining of the New York Times and how it deals with these kind of forces. Maybe, I just don't think we know. And I think you're right about being careful not to conflate the editorial pages, or I guess they call it the opinion pages now, right?
Right.
With the news pages, it's a publisher's paper, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. Like A.G. Sulzberger, before him Arthur Sulzberger, before him Punch Sulzberger, they could do whatever the heck they wanted to do, right? The thing is, did they influence it? Did they, I don't want to say metal because it's still their paper, but did they get involved with the news coverage? And from my research, for the most part, with some exceptions, for the most part, they did not.
I agree. That's different. You know, right.
Yeah, that's different, right? That's different. But at the end of the day,
No, I was going to say, when we talked about the great Washington coverage, some of those great investigative reporters, I mean, Charlie Savage and Mark Mazzetti, I mean, that is really a talented group of people. So I don't know that they know what woke is. But,
I think that's right.
You mentioned the Sulzbergers. And I'm primarily thinking that the two Sulzbergers in your era was Punch Sulzberger, who was sort of a larger-than-life figure, mainstay of New York society and the journalism business. And then his goofy kid, Pinch, they called him at the time, took over. But he was pretty prescient. I mean, over 20 years ago, he said against his father's wishes, you know, we have to turn to digital. And man, that saved the paper, Adam.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. When I started this book, a friend of mine said to me, you are going to have to deal with the legacy of Arthur Sulzberger Jr. And because of his sort of personal effect, as you said, but also because he had to get rid of two executive editors, right? That's pretty big mistakes, right? Howell Raines and Jill Abramson. But I think at the end of the day, when I finished the book, in my opinion, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., is kind of a hero, right? He saved the paper. He was, even as a young man, he was very forward-looking about how the world was going digital. And I think there are two reasons for this, which I write about in the book. One is he's a former wire service guy, right? So, like, he didn't have the kind of adherence that you and I might have to the idea of write a story, file it at 4 o'clock, it'll appear at 7 the next morning. Right. He's like, write a story and it posts, which is basically what we do now. But the other thing is, and I'm not being flip, he's a Star Trek fan. So he would talk about, even 30 years ago, I don't care if we have to beam this information into their heads, our readers' heads, we're going to get it to them. And I think he did a really good job of sort of setting the lodestar. I think that's the right cliche, right? Of where the paper should be going. And finally, you know, he was the one ultimately that made the decision about doing the second paywall, right? And it could have failed. It did not. And I think if it failed, it would have been on his shoulders. He would have ruined the New York Times or whatever. But I think the fact that it's such a success and that, you know, I think the paper's up to what, 10.5 million digital subscribers now.
Unbelievable.
He deserves to do a big, unbelievable, right? A victory lap on that. So I agree with that. He was a complicated figure to write about for the reasons you said, but I walked away from that having immense respect for him and what he accomplished.
Well, this is a personal side. You don't have to comment on it. Joe Abramson is one of my dearest friends. I think she had her flaws for sure, but she was a brilliant editor and I think she got screwed. But that's my personal observation. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, the infighting at the New York Times makes politics look tame sometimes by comparison. I mean, for all of its greatness, there was so much pettiness, so much ego, so much knife stabbing. Man, it doesn't sound like a very pleasant place to work, Adam.
I mean, I think that's true. I think that's always the case when you put a lot of really talented, ambitious, insecure, dare I say, people in a room, which is often a zero-sum kind of atmosphere. And it can be really difficult, right? I think that's particularly the case with editors. I never wanted to become an editor. If you look at editors, it's really up and out. And we've seen really extraordinarily talented journalists, as you said, who've been forced out of the paper just because of that's the way the world works. But it's, you know, it's really, really complicated. It's really competitive and complicated. And I think a large reason for that is there are layers and layers of redundancies of talent in the New York Times. And I would guess that the other places do, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, at least until the past couple of years, I would say. I'm not sure anymore. So like if somebody flames out, there's somebody right behind them, maybe equally as talented, maybe even more talented, ready to step in. Is that a healthy work environment? I don't know. But for being a reporter, it's certainly a great place to work.
Well, when I was at the Wall Street Journal, I named a new editor and I suggested he have lunch with David Rogers, a brilliant reporter who was who could be difficult. And he went and asked him, and Rogers looked at him and said, "I don't eat with editors," which I think is a view that more than a few reporters have. Let me do one final thing, and I'll turn it back to James. Did you get any blowback? I mean, you really were you did a terrific reporting job. There were things that all kinds of people, you know, Sulzberger and Raines and everybody else must have cringed. Did you get any blowback?
Nothing major. Let me tell you why. I'll tell you what the less major stuff was in a second. I think part of it is my feeling on a book like this is you only get to do it once, right? And my publisher basically said, take the time you need. You know, I had a fact checker. I checked stuff again and again. I ran stuff past people, right? I ran, which I would never do in a newspaper story, but I ran sections past people to make sure I had it right. I didn't want people to be surprised. So I was really nervous, the way I'm nervous when I, you know, file the difficult story, that there would be blowback. There was nothing that I consider serious or devastating, no corrections, you know, except for really minor stuff. One of the executive editors who said he was overall okay with the way he was covered, had two criticisms, which I'll share with you. One I agree with, one I don't. One is he thought I should have written about WikiLeaks and how that sort of changed the New York Times culture, that the New York Times was working with an outside organization to cover stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a really good point. I wish I had thought of that. The other was he said that he thought that I didn't quite get across the joy of working at the New York Times on big stories. And I think I did when you read the word joy in this context, when you read the chapters on September 11, when you read the chapters on the explosion of the Challenger, I think I get across why it is that people want to work at the Times and why it becomes a mission bigger to themselves. That it's not just all infighting and who's up and who's down, blah, blah, blah. But it's also like, you know, the paper is covering really important things that I think is generally dedicated, and I'm not saying they're going to get it right all the time, but dedicated to getting it right. And I think that's really important.
I think you captured that, James.
So, Adam, Harvard University did a report in 2016 campaign. New York Times wrote more stories about Hillary's emails than Trump's business practices. Does anybody at the time said, you know, maybe we got disoriented here and we were covering the wrong thing too much?
You know, I think that if you talk to Dean Baquet, who's the executive editor at the time, who I bet you have talked to.
And I'm going to see him in March, and trust me, I'll bring it up.
Okay. Well, I think I'm going to see you there too at the book festival, right?
Good.
So, I think if you go back and look, there was a lot of coverage of the emails, right? You and I can argue about whether that was a legitimate story or not. Whatever.
I don't think there's much argument now, but go ahead.
There was one day when there were three front page above the fold, or there was top of the page stories when Comey reopened the investigation. It's hard to look back at that and say it deserves three stories. I think that the paper came under a lot of criticism for that, and I think kind of correctly. I write about that a bit in the book, but I think more and more there's a real legacy to that.
Well, okay, so, save me a place on your dance card for the book festival. So I guess one of the, there's two, like, I don't know, we call them Louisiana Gafunk moments. One of them was involved James Bennett, where but my understanding that the editor did not want to fire him, but somebody said that they felt unsafe in a newsroom with James Bennett, as if James Bennett would be a threat. That's right up there when Bob Woodward, who I love, is a good friend of mine, said that he was threatened by
Gene
someone
Sperling.
In the Obama White
by
House
Gene
about some
Sperling.
Book. It was James. I was in my car on Chapatula Street. I had to pull off the street because I was like, Gene is going to get you with that, you know, leaky pen in his top pocket. But I mean, two people I can assure you that are no physical danger to anybody is James Bennett and Gene Sperling. I mean, you can't beat that, man. I love having you on the show. I can't wait to see you in New Orleans. I think this is a terrific book because you can't just cover modern America and the Times for whatever it is, and you can call it a lot, and a lot of names would be accurate, but it's just one of the leading in quote institutions unquote in the United States and has been for a long time. So congratulations on really, really important book.
I second everything James just said. You know, just one quick story. You know, I thought Abe Rosenthal died, I think, 2006. Mm-hmm. And his greatest accomplishment was the Pentagon Papers. That was the last thing.
I think that's
then,
right, yeah.
And then Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep did a movie about it, and it was focused almost exclusively on the Washington Post. Someone should have checked his tombstone that day because that would have driven him crazy.
Can you imagine? I can't even imagine. I just didn't saw when I saw it. I can't even imagine it.
Thank God
he wasn't alive to see that.
Adam, you have done, this is a tour de force. It's a great book, whether you're into journalism or not. The Times, all the scandals, all the great journalism, all the infighting. It's fabulous. Adam Nagorny, thank you for being with us. And everybody out there, read this book, The Times.
Terrific, man. Congratulations. And I think this is an indispensable book, not just in American journalism, but American history. I really mean that.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate you having me on. Those kind words about the book. That was great.
Thank you. And now for the outrage of the week. America First Legal, headed by Stephen Miller, the immigrant-hating Trump acolyte, is challenging the National Football League, a private organization's policy of trying to hire more minority coaches under the so-called Rooney Rule. They charge this punishes other possible candidates, whites, as if they haven't had a chance. The facts are over 60% of pro players football players are minorities. And not long ago, there were almost no head coaches of color. With a prodding of the Rooney Rule, next year, 9 NFL head coaches will be minorities, 6 blacks. The implicit charge by Miller's group is that black coaches really aren't up to it. He doesn't know much about the game or has never heard of Mike Tomlin, head coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers, owned by the Rooney family. Tomlin has won over 63% of his games, gone to 11 playoffs, and won a Super Bowl. Try to find another coach not named Belichick or Andy Reid with that record. Tomlin is black. Miller is following in the footsteps of Rush Limbaugh, who over 20 years ago belittled the idea of a black quarterback in the NFL. They just weren't intellectually up to it. As we prepare for hopefully a great Super Bowl Sunday, recall 2 weekends ago when Kansas City Chiefs defeated the Baltimore Ravens, a contest between the two best quarterbacks in pro football, Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson. You got it. Both are black.
So one of the I said... you know, based on this stupid Taylor Swift stuff, that one of the secrets to a happy life is to be amused, not to get mad at fools. And as my daddy told me when I was a little boy, I got mad at somebody for being stupid. And he said, son, living in Louisiana, being mad at stupidity is like being mad at grass. And I think that that makes a calmer life. There's something, you just can't, you got to believe this. A guy in the Daily Beast, Michael Ian Black, points out that Kellyanne Conway wrote an op-ed that the New York Times took about who Trump should be picked for vice president. And I'm pretty sure the intent of the piece was that he should pick Kellyanne Conway. And in Black argues Conway is shameless enough to unlock the keys to Trump's, quote, syphilitic mind, unquote. I think we're getting some traction out there with a combination of all-out flattery and interest. And then she goes on to, honestly, I'm not kidding you. And Kellyanne says that Trump famously treats women very well. Just in the same goddamn week that he raped a woman. I mean, and the stunning thing is they don't even remotely see the hypocrisy in this.
No, James, you're wrong. They don't care.
Oh, okay. But yeah. Whatever. If the person you work for and every person has weakness, you generally don't go right to the most famous weakness and the most current weakness that the person has. And I this is where I think the Times should have published that, because to the few people of me that really are amused by fools, this is all world goddamn fooldom. That with a straight face. Trump treats women. I mean, if I go back in every misogynistic quaint, he raped that woman. Oh my God. It just, please, people, if you want to be a happier life, you want to sleep better, you want to be more relaxed, you don't want to throw shit at walls, you just got to laugh at this. This even tops the Taylor Swift stuff.
They give you plenty of material.
Oh, God, it never stops.
Okay, now for the terrific questions we get every week from our listeners. The hardest job I have is culling them down to 6 or 7. We got 2 about Nikki Haley, James. Nancy in Philadelphia says she has no chance of beating Trump. So what's the real strategy here? You know, she's staying simply as a backup if something happens to him. Why is she doing it? And likewise, we have a question, another question from Casper, from Gina in Casper, Wyoming, who says, isn't it likely that Haley staying in the race is actually helping Trump? If he was, it was wrapped up already, wouldn't he be out of the news?
Well, I guess if anyone knew she was still in a race and voted, I think none of the above beat a 2-1.
Yeah, but she finished second to none of the above.
Yeah. I mean, look, do I think it, would Trump rather see her out? Yes, and I should have. If I come back, is something else. I want to come back as a billionaire Republican donor, because this is the stupidest class of people in the United States. I don't know how they made $1 billion, but they keep pumping money into this. There's something really stupid about these people. It's inexplicable, but I think none of the above got 62 and she got 30 or something. But she likes being in the light, so what can you say?
Well, here's a question from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Chad says, if Trump becomes ill or dies or is jailed, which won't happen, he won't be jailed before the election, but if the others happen up to the day of the inauguration, I assume the RNC would select his replacement. Correct. Who might they select? Mike Johnson, Nikki Haley? I can rule those two out right now. Your thoughts, please. I don't know. Let's see who he picks as a running mate. If something happens after that, that might be a candidate. You know, you might want to look to someone like J.D. Vance. You got to look to a Trumper. He dominates the party. And without Trump, it's still a Trump party. And someone has got to be, if they get to that situation, who will be acceptable and actually enthusiastically so to the Trump base.
Well, if he wants to, the Trump base, if the Republican Party wants to keep the Trump base enthusiastic, why not Stephen Miller? He fits right into him. I mean, yeah. You know, talking.
Well, he does.
I don't. He checks every box, but he checks the biggest one. He's racist.
Or how about that Holocaust denier that he had lunch with or dinner with at Mar-a-Lago?
Nick Fuentes. Yeah.
And Kanye West. Yeah.
I love the Jews that support Trump, and they don't like what Ilhan Omar says. And Trump has dinner with Nick Fuentes. All right, goddammit, I've had enough. You know, I mean, it's just like, you can't, the secret to life is you can't get mad about this because it'll ruin your life. But I'm going to tell you, it's out and out hilarious.
It is.
And the most hilarious non-aware people in the world are Jews for Trump. Jesus Christ.
Well, Will in Arlington, Virginia, right across the river from me, says, you guys have talked about how important state parties can be. You know, people like Ben Wickler in Wisconsin. A lot of state Republican parties, Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, are broke or in debt or engaged in ferocious infighting. Will that affect the elections in 2024, James?
You know, it might. I mean, the Michigan Republican Party is disintegrated. It looks like Arizona, right, the same. And we have some strong ones. One of the things that we're going to try to do is maybe get Ben on, or, you know, maybe have a show with several party chairs. Because, I mean, most people come up to me and they want to help. They want to do something, but they can't leave. Maybe they have programs where people can do call-ins or write postcards or something. We should explore.
Maybe have Ben and the Virginia State Chair. That'd be two great guests. Yeah. All right. Jake in Whidbey Island, Washington, asks, that's Bob Mary's territory, why are so many Democratic pundits confused by the fact that Trump's malfeasance is not reflected in the polls? The Trump right has successfully created a propaganda media ecosystem that doesn't allow facts to penetrate. Am I wrong? Jake, you're actually onto something. And here's the difference. You know, the mainstream media is larger, but the mainstream media says, well, it's not totally on the one hand, on the other hand, but if they criticize one, they want to sort of criticize the other. You know something? The Trump media, Fox News, they have no such inhibitions. They are just into propaganda all the time. And, you know, and it works. It really does. And I know people who wonder seriously, who were involved in the Nixon impeachment, they doubt it could have happened if Fox News had been around back then.
Yeah, and the other thing is, and of course I'm very big on this, the mainstream media, I guess, you know, that's whatever we are, it normalizes this. So they published the Kellyanne Conway op-ed. I don't know. It's like normal to take to the paper and talk about how great Trump is to women. And there's no editor's note to say that within 72 hours of this, he was decided that he raped someone. I mean, there's no way that I could go on a conservative site and talk about how Bill Clinton was an icon of what a, you know, pristine story book marriage was. But that's what she did. Right? And it's so normal. Well, you pick a woman and these are the strengths and these are the weaknesses, and you pick up and these are the strengths and these are the weaknesses. And, you know, what's really undervalued is just this tremendous way, his unbelievable respect for women. I mean, anybody's ever heard him talk. I mean, blood coming out of her eyes and Peg, and I mean, I don't want to go through the whole thing, but that therein, our friend, that's the problem. When you want a straight face, and you know, well, we gave her space. She told us what she thought, and we're very open, and that's great. And I think you should have different points of view, but this one is like, come on.
That's normal. And they've normalized it. Sam in San Jose, California, notes the inspector general was investigating a 2018 complaint. I sort of remember this, that the Trump White House was essentially a huge pill mill. Why hasn't the media picked up on this? I'm outraged. Why aren't the Democrats picking up on this? And to quote the great Carville, they should be picking up on this, like, quote, humping this like a young dog on an old furniture, end quote. Hey, Sam.
Well, if I said I'd like to come back as a Republican billionaire because you don't really have to be smart. Excuse me, Admiral Stravinsky, but I want to come back as a Navy admiral. If this guy was an admiral.
You're talking about Ronnie Jackson now, admiral. Distinguished member of the House of Representatives, as in not. Right.
And a retired Navy admiral.
Let's raise a glass to Ronnie Jackson. Or seven or eight.
Was it, Bobby, let me ask you a technical question. Was it an IG report or was it the Navy?
I don't remember,
report?
James. I remember the issue, but I didn't. I don't know if it was IG or the Navy.
I don't either. Somehow or another, I think I remember that the Navy did it. But
Sam,
it doesn't matter.
Sam, we'll get back to you on that next week, I promise. No, it doesn't. Gordon in Norwood, Michigan says, I know that Michigan's electoral votes are in jeopardy, given the ongoing war in Gaza. Is it a lost cause? If so, could Florida be in play? How about Texas? Gordon, there's a problem, but I think you somewhat exaggerated. There is a large Muslim population in Michigan, and they are upset with Biden on the Israel-Gaza war. At some point, they may find out about Donald Trump's views, which would be far more hostile to them than anything they don't like about Joe Biden. I think Michigan is still a toss-up, lean Biden, slightly state. I don't think Florida or Texas are.
Well, I will disagree here. The war is killing Biden. Just killing him. And it's killing among our voters, and we think about that in Key State and Dearborn, and but these are really hardworking people. So we think it's just the people in Dearborn and the kids at the University of Michigan is the problem. It's way, way deeper than that. Way deeper. It's killing us with black voters. And I can't unring the bell. I could go back and argue this back and forth. Biden is being profoundly hurt by this war.
I agree.
Politically. I mean, profoundly hurt. And it's not it's not an Ann Arbor-Dearborn problem. All right? It's a problem everywhere. It's a serious, an Appleton, Wisconsin problem. All right? It's everywhere that you look. Yes. And they're going to have to, if this war is still, if the war in Gaza, if they're still bombing the shit out of Gaza and the Democratic Convention don't go, it's going to be very, very, very ugly. And Blinken and Biden have got to tell Netanyahu the way the cow ate the cabbage. But this is not an isolated problem. It's a problem across the board. It is not just a problem with educated young kids and American citizens of Arab descent. It's much deeper, much more profound, and much more dangerous. And they're not. Of course, Trump's horrible. He told Bibi he'd do anything he wanted. I mean, just give him a blank check. And of course, you remember that the great Abraham Accords.
They just forgot one thing in history. The Abraham Accords. Right. There's only one thing they forgot. The Palestinians.
They cut the Palestinians out the deal, but on October 7th, 2023, the Palestinians cut their way back into the deal. And it was all a money-making deal. It was MBS and Jared and the Bahrainians and the Qataris and, you know, and Netanyahu. And the money was going to go from the Qataris to Hamas because they had everything under control. You know, they were issuing work visas in the northern Gaza border. And we're paying a horrible price. And it's going to actually, right now, the issue is benefiting Trump.
It is.
And you just want to go, I feel like going on television and just doing a screaming at people for 2 minutes. The fuck are you thinking? But it's hurting. Ain't no doubt about that.
Yeah. No question. James, our final question is from Jeff, and great first name, in St. Pete Beach, Florida. He says, I think he's talking, you tell your buds in Biden land to get Taylor Swift to write a song for Biden, like Sinatra did for JFK. What else can Biden do for the youth vote?
You know, I of course, think that Taylor Swift is like one, you know, it's kind of a remarkable story, and I love her romance with Mr. Kelce. By the way, Taylor Swift was from Berks County, Pennsylvania.
She was.
Which is it's a kind of red county.
It is. Right? I think I thought it went for Trump at least in 16.
I looked it up. It did. Yeah. It wasn't like, but yes, and you just have to know. I think Redding, I always heard, and my visual observation concern is, has the highest number of bars per capita.
Oh, man, I think there's some places in Wisconsin and some places, college towns.
I'm not going to argue, but that was part of the mythology of Redding.
We ought to do research on that, James.
Yeah, no, we should. Bars per capita.
Maybe on-site research.
Right. I know Shreveport is high for churches per capita. But anyway, but my point is, and he went to the University of Cincinnati. It's just a great school. Don't get me wrong.
The Bearcats.
He played for Brian Kelly.
And she actually met Andy Reid well before she ever knew Travis Kelce when he was the coach of the Philadelphia Eagles.
you can say, I like him as a football player. God, kill me. I bet on Baltimore. He had 11 receptions. I wish he'd have broken up with him before the game.
The right wing tells us she's a distraction, James. She's distracting his game. He broke the all-time record.
Beat
Jerry Rice's record.
A receiver. Yeah, but that son of a bitch is not distracted. I want to get out the way. Wow. And the brother, was all-pro center for the Eagles forever. And it seemed like a really nice family, I don't get it, but that, you know, the University of Cincinnati is that now the top of the elite, you know, snobby people. Hawk is stupid. Jesus, don't get mad.
You're trying to check yourself on that. I can see. I mean, you start, then you try to pull back a little bit. It's not easy.
You have to be amusing. Berks County, Pennsylvania, the University of Cincinnati are conspiring to make everybody transgender. And now, of course, I just have to mention this, is Trump is now promoting Bud Light because he has $5 million worth of stock in it. The one thing that politicians are more important than anything else, but Trump is, nothing trumps his money. and he's getting ready to lose a lot of it. Judge Ngorian's getting ready to drop a fucking hammer on him like you ain't gonna believe.
Well, but this whole thing, this whole left-wing conspiracy may be exposed because Tucker Carlson is over in Moscow. And so he's working with the Russians. And so keep your eyes open. Tucker's on the job. All right, listen, keep those letters coming in. We love them. If we didn't get to them this week, we'll get to them next week. So thank you very much. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, The Washington Post, Henson Shaving, and ExpressVPN in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.